back among the land of the healthy. We have a rule in our committee. I just go over it every day. Some of you are kind of bored with it, but, you know, it's always a nice reminder. Turn off the cell phones, PDAs, and any electronic devices where you make a contribution to the Common School Fund. And if you don't know our procedures, you do sign-ups over there on the left. We have a really good meeting today. I have to leave at 8:45 to go next door to deal with a very contentious bill that I have up over there. And I'll be leaving my vice chair in charge, Senator Cruz, who will be here shortly, and then I'll be back. But I hope to get the bulk of this great presentation this morning. We have an informational meeting, so I'll open an informational meeting. Not that I think I don't need to do that, but from the State Board of Education, we're going to learn all about what you've been doing on those high school graduation requirements. So, Mr. Berger, do you have anyone with you?
Chair Walker and member of the committee.
We're sort of a subcommittee at the moment.
The Boyle member.
For the record, I'm Jerry Berger. I'm here today in my role as chair of the State Board of Education. And I'd like to introduce some people because today and tomorrow is the State Board of Education meeting, the monthly meeting.
I think we knew that, and that's why you're here today.
So we have a lot of people here I'd like to introduce. To my immediate right is Mickey Squire, a board member from Bend.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Duncan Wise, vice chair of the board from Portland.
Good morning. You know Duncan, good morning.
Steve Bogart, Steve, board member from Baker City.
And we've heard from Mr. Bogart here before.
Artemio Paz, board member from Eugene.
Welcome.
We also have two of our representatives that sit on the board that give us advice. They're not voting members. We have Doug Dougherty, superintendent, Seaside School District, been a great addition to the board. And Roger Will, counselor, Hillsborough High. So those are members that are here today to... They will give us a critique on how we do today regarding this presentation. So they're very open and honest, so we will know how well we do.
Well, I appreciate that.
At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Duncan Wise, who will start us through the presentation we have, and then Nikki will finish that. Then we're open for questions.
Okay. Are you going to use this device here? So we'll lower the lights a little bit so we can see it better.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Duncan Wise, member of the board. Nikki and I are going to go through a presentation. I'm going to do my part relatively quickly, especially given the chair's need to leave. We want you to have a chance to hear the whole presentation. Mm-hmm. I want to give you an overview of the high school diploma requirements that we've been working on for the last couple years or so. I'm going to go through the why for the new diploma. Nikki's going to go through what the diploma requirements are, and I think you're probably going to be more interested in Nikki because I think you know the why. We've talked about it. I've had a chance to appear before this committee before, and I know you've heard a lot about the changes that are going on in the economy and our society that require us to set higher standards than ever before in history, and really that's what this diploma is all about. So I'll just briefly touch on the why here. What our goal is that we have a system where each student is going to be able to demonstrate the knowledge and skills necessary to be successful for advanced learning, work, and citizenship. And of these three, I want to stress citizenship. I know because as a business representative, we often talk about work. But if you think about what is going to be required to be a good citizen, to sit down and listen, for example, to Senator Morris's presentation on public finance, that's pretty sophisticated stuff. And you need to be pretty well educated to be able to digest complicated matters as a citizen in Oregon. And we need everybody to be able to participate in the kind of society we're emerging into. And so I would stress we need to think about high levels of skills and knowledge for everyone to be successful in the 21st century. Why? Again, today's world demands more skills for all students. And I stress this all. We are moving from a world where we could accept a certain number of very highly educated citizens to serve in the professional class, the managerial class, if you will, where everyone else could basically work off brawn power and earn a good wage. That is not the society we're moving into. We're moving into a society we indeed are in a society where everybody needs to be highly skilled and knowledgeable to be successful in terms of earning family wage jobs. We understand the global economy is changing and that we're facing stiff competition. We understand, again, that the workplace has changed, and as we look at new jobs, they require higher and higher levels of education. I've had the chance to speak to you before. We believe a very high percentage of Oregon adults need to have some form of post-secondary education, and all jobs require higher skills. Again, another data point that we presented, again, many of the new jobs require high school, require skills and knowledge beyond the high school level.
You have 7 out of 10 of, if you flip back there, mm-hmm. 7 out of 10 of the hottest jobs. What are the hottest jobs, the
well,
top 10?
Well, they're a variety. They're in the service sector. They're in... and again, that will change. I want to stress right now we're seeing a lot in the medical field, and again, assumed to be highly skilled service jobs. And we are seeing a lot of jobs that are going to be replaced. If you take a look at, for example, one sector I just was talking with, the utility industry, a lot of those folks are retiring. A lot of high skilled jobs are going to be coming opening as the boomers move into their next stage. So it's not only new jobs, but it's many of the existing jobs that I'll use state service as an example. If you think about the next 10 years in public service, these are high-wage, high-skilled jobs. I would argue we're going to see turnover, and those jobs, if you take a look at the requirements, demand high levels of knowledge and skills for success. So there's a wide range of categories. The labor market is broad and vast and with a lot of diversity. And a theme, it doesn't really matter what sector we look into, what we see is an upskilling of job requirements in terms of how the work is getting organized, whether it's manufacturing, services, in nearly every area. The skill requirements are going up, and I would stress, we don't know what the economy is going to look like 20 years from now. And if we want to, it's a good, we should be banking on skills, I mean, if we want to be successful. Those young people graduating, I think, can be expecting to be in a world where skills and knowledge are going to be key for success. Again, the workplace has changed, as I say. I'm moving backwards here. Okay. Technical problem myself. We also, as I mentioned, to mention manufacturing specifically, I spend a lot of time talking with folks in the traded sector and those firms that are selling their goods and services outside the state, and we're hearing demand for technical jobs all over the economy, huge shortages. And again, the jobs on manufacturing floor today are high-skilled jobs. They require math skills, analytic skills, teamwork skills, very high-skilled jobs. And frankly, we aren't meeting those demands in the current workforce. I hear companies complaining about this all the time. Now, the problem is that a lot of graduates today out of high school are not ready for that kind of a world. If you take a look at the data in the colleges and the community colleges, there's a very high level of remedial education, different estimates, but you know, the ACT suggests that only 1 in 5 students have the skills to be successful. So we've got a long, long way to go. What we also have learned, and this is the most important and good news, is that if you challenge students to higher levels, they will meet the challenge. Sarah Boley in Beaverton, I remember her quote in the Oregonian. She's a wonderful principal and now vice superintendent. She says, "I have found that it's very seldom the case that people drop out because we're asking too much of them. It's much more often the case that they're not being asked to do enough." And what we need to do is create a rigorous, relevant education system that enables students to be challenged and to meet the demands for the 21st century. That's what we need to be doing. Again, as we've looked at high school graduation rates around the country, those places that have taken adopted higher standards, for example, Indiana and Green, have actually seen their high school graduation rates climb, not go down. And the final point I would make about the need for a diploma that demands high skills of all students is that the skills required in the jobs that students might be going to directly out of high school or with a slight, you know, additional technical training after high school are roughly the same skills that college required. An ACT study, a rigorously conducted study for ACHIEVE, found that. And essentially, the levels of reading, math, problem solving, and communication skills are very similar in the workplace as they are what the University of Oregon or OSU will be requiring upon graduation. It's not like there's two different pathways now. We need to set a high bar for all young people. So that's the why. In terms of the process, briefly, I just want to stress we have spent a lot of time on this, and we have tried to engage the field as broadly as we can. We started with a policy paper well over a year ago. We got feedback from the parties, and then we had a board retreat with 150 stakeholders. Over the last year, we've had 300 community meetings, 5,000 surveys turned in, and now with the initial decision on the diploma requirements that Nikki will present, we're going to be setting up advisory committees to continue to engage the field. We know that the concern is that if a top-down design without engagement of the field is problematic at best. We need to be out and talking with people, adjusting and making modifications. We know that. This map just shows you where the statewide meetings were held. This department did a great job both on the technical side here and on the outreach. We got some funding from the Gates Foundation to help on this. I think we've really been trying to reach out and connect with the school community in particular. So that's the why. We've had a lot of conversations, a lot of feedback, and a decision, and Nikki is going to describe our decision. Sure, sure.
Chair Walker, member of the committee. For the record, I'm Nikki Squire, member of the State Board of Education. So given all of the research that was done and the input that we had, and the evidence that we had from after high school receivers of students, colleges, workforce people, what we have decided to do at this point is summarized here. The Oregon diploma requirements that I'll describe essentially fall in three categories. The first of those are credit requirements, which is what we traditionally have thought about with diplomas. Credits in specific academic areas. Secondly, a set of essential skills that are more across the academic areas. For example, the capacity to write for a variety of purposes, to think critically. And the third general area is that the entire system is to be based on a personalized plan for each student. This is not a new diploma requirement. It was put in place by the board several years ago, but it is a piece that we are keeping in hopes that it will give us greater success for all students with the additional diploma requirements.
Okay, hold it a sec, because
yes,
that one I have to ask a question about.
Okay.
You had a personalized plan for each student that the board made as a requirement several years ago?
Yes.
The success rate of that is?
Well, that's a hard question to answer, because although the board made the decision about 5 years ago, this year's senior class is the first class for which it was in place, because it's actually a planning process that starts in grade 7. So if you'll ask us that question again, next year we'll have at least one cohort of kids that we can give you the answer to that about. Yeah, we also have a member of an advisor of our board that we can ask to. Do you want to do that now, Jerry?
We can do it now or later. My concern is, and I'm just going to lay it out there for you.
Uh-huh.
We got the SIM and the CAM, and I think that whomever, and I'm not going to lay the blame at your feet, didn't do the marketing of this new program. So colleges, universities didn't give a whit that you were requiring a SIM and a CAM, or it was the legislature actually who implemented that. So no one cared except the high schools and the students weren't even made to care. Some were. Some districts took it very seriously, and they're very upset that you want to do away with the SIM and the CAM because they're doing very well, especially some of the small school districts. But if you have a personalized plan and you have all these new requirements, I want to make sure you're going to market it. It's like any new product. You have to market it. And so when you tell me that you have a personalized plan for each student and you implemented it several years ago, I don't see it. So that's kind of
why. I think it would be helpful to have Roger Will, counselor at Hillsborough High School, could give you. He's working with that daily.
Okay.
Roger, why don't you come up?
Do we have another chair?
I can.
Or
I can
you can step back, Mr. Berger. Thank you. He'll just step back. Okay. State your name for the record, please.
Roger Will. And Chair Walker, what I would say is that it was voted on by the board. I think it was in 2001, but the implementation date was 2007.
Okay.
So it allowed schools time to get on board and get together a plan and profile. Okay. And actually, it's very helpful because it allows students to see the connections between what their goals are and the classes they need to take
right. In
high school. So it really does prepare them for kind of the challenges and set that framework for where they want to head in their education.
But, Mr. Will, I have a question for you. You're a counselor, high school counselor.
Correct.
How many high schools have people like you?
All high schools have counselors. At least that's my assumption. I mean, the high schools
don't, and some of them have cut counselors because of the budget. So my question is, if you have this requirement and your implementation date is now 2007, how is it being met if we don't have a counselor? And maybe now they do because you've got a new requirement upon the school. Because I think this is critical. But you've got to have somebody that can individually meet with every single student in your high school. And some of those high schools are huge. They have a huge number of students.
Well, you know, I can only use our school as an example. We actually integrate this into many classes so that students have the opportunity to meet with a counselor. And teachers are also a part of this process. It's actually called kind of falls under the comprehensive guidance program that is required by every high school in the state to have. And so I do believe when I talk to other colleagues in other schools that I've not heard of a school that doesn't actually have a high school that doesn't have a counselor, but everyone is aware of what the policy is and are meeting the challenges.
Okay. Tell us, Andrew Walker, what your load is. How many students do you
have? Well, as a counselor, I would have about 400 students. And the personal plan and profile actually starts in seventh grade, so it actually starts in the middle school and then transitions into the high school. And then we kind of take on what the planning had started in the middle school and then continue that out as we forecast for students. And it's kind of most schools have paralleled the plan and profile into forecasting. That's when you're selecting your courses for the following year. And what it really allows students to do is have this discussion about if I want to be a lawyer, if I want to be a journeyman or an electrician, what are the courses in my high school that I really need to take? Before, what would happen, students would set these plans about, I want to be an electrician, but not have an idea on how to get there. What are the courses I really need to take? Math courses, chemistry, physics. You go down the line. And this really allows students to say, if I want to be an electrician, here's the pathway I need to take. Counselors, teachers are working with them to say, here's a 4-year plan, a 6-year plan for you to follow. At the end of that plan, if you've taken these courses, then you're ready for the next step.
But at some point along that path, when they start in seventh grade, because I'd be hard-pressed to find a seventh grader who really knows what they want to do. I mean, they might have an idea. I mean, every child wants to be a fireman. I think most boys want to be a fireman. And girls want to be nurses and this and that. And that all changes they grow up.
That's the beauty of it, because there is flexibility.
Okay.
That's the important piece of having those discussions yearly with every student. Because you're right, they do change. But the real piece is when they change, what are the next level of courses you would need to take? This planning piece is so essential, because if you don't have the planning and someone says, I want to be a fireman as a 5-year-old, and it changes to an electrician, it changes to going into law, what happened before when I first got into counseling is kids would have no real idea of, well, what courses should I be taking? They would guess. They would talk to their friends. Some would have family support. Now with the planner profile, the goal is that you meet with a high school official, a teacher, mm-hmm. a counselor, to say, here's the direction you need to take to get to that next level, even as their plan changes.
Well, I appreciate that. And I just want to make sure we've got the counselors there in the middle school and we've got them in the high school to track that and to also make sure they explore with the kids alternative careers that are, you know, I don't want all the girls shoved into this one or all the boys shoved into this one because they do cross. And, you know, more women are getting into traditional fields that men have been in and vice versa. It's really great to see that variety. But if you don't have the staff to help these kids stay on track with their plan, this all just blows up and means nothing.
I agree with that, and I think the best part of this is the investment into it really means that all students, every student, has that option to talk to someone. Okay. It's not just the student or the parent that, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Right.
This is about every student in the state of Oregon being able to talk to an educated adult about their plans, their choices, and then saying, okay, when I switch my plan, when I make a new decision, here are the courses I need to take. When I first started in counseling, that didn't happen. And really, you would see students begin to fall through the crack, or if they had a dream or an aspiration, you know, they would just have it alone. And this really kind of personalizes that experience. And to me, watching, you know, lots of students kind of, because we started planning for this, you know, 4 years ago, really, mm-hmm. and started, we use a computerized system to help students engage in what they're interested in. It actually allows them to look at what courses they should be taking. So it's not only coming from an adult in our school, but it comes from a computerized system, an educational software that says, here are the courses that you need to take to be in that X career field.
Okay.
And so this is actually truly, really excited. And really, as the State Board has talked for 18 months, this is really the platform for mm-hmm. reform because mm-hmm. it allows schools and students to have this discussion openly.
Thank you, Mr. Will. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Does any member of the committee have a question? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Squire, you're back on tap.
Okay, then starting with the first general category, the credit requirements in the new diploma, you see that there will be 24 total credits, which was actually legislative action in the last mm-hmm. Session.
And there are districts that do more than this.
Oh, yes, many. As a matter of fact,
some do 27 even.
Yes, the information that we have is that for as many as three-quarters of the high schools in the state, the increase in credit requirements will not require a change upward for them.
Yeah, and when we introduced this legislation and passed it, I did that research, and I was shocked and pleasantly surprised that especially some of the smaller districts were doing 27, 28 credits, and some of the urban districts were cheating and doing the 22. So I was glad to move that up.
So this plan is in compliance with your legislative direction. The 24 credits may be met through a variety of courses and experiences, and we'll take a look at that. And students may earn credit by demonstrating proficiency. That's been an option that school districts mm-hmm. have had and that many school districts take advantage of. These new diploma requirements say students will have that opportunity. So one of the challenges we'll be talking about is how to make the opportunity to demonstrate proficiency in some not so straightforward classes or skills can be developed.
It's sort of like in college. When I was in college back in the 70s, you could challenge a class.
Mm-hmm.
You paid, well, back in the 70s, you paid $25, which is, you know, probably costs a lot more now, and you could challenge a class. And if you passed, you got the credits. So a lot of students were doing that.
Yeah, it's the very same idea.
Okay. And the board will be developing what those demonstrations of proficiency are?
We actually think that some of the ways of doing that are already in place as a result of the work that has been done with accountability and SIM requirements and standards. There are other areas where there's a great deal more development to be done. We'll be getting advice from the implementation advisory team and doing a good deal of work. This is certainly one of the areas where there's much to be done. Within the credit requirements, specifics are shown on this slide, and along the right-hand side you see the proposed implementation timeline. Some of them are already in the law. English will go from 3 to 4 credits by legislative action, effective with the class of 2010. Those kids are in high school now. Math from 2 to 3 credits, same timeline as a result of legislation last session. Our additional requirement is that for high school graduation credit, that work will be at the Algebra 1 level or above. And that is to go in effect by 2014. This is the area of the new graduation requirements in which we got the most pushback from people in the field.
We heard.
Yeah. And it wasn't so much as we went around and did meetings that people didn't see the value at all, but concern about how will, you know, where will we find enough teachers? Are there some kids for whom this is going to require additional time and tutoring, and where are we going to get the resources to do that, and so forth? I think one key thing here is to remember that we're talking about Algebra 1 or higher content, not necessarily the traditional course sequence that we think of from when we were kids of Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2. Those math standards may very well be embedded in a pre-engineering class, in a technical math class, in an integrated math class, even some of them in sciences. So the key is having those math standards identified and then having some flexibility for schools to affirm that they have been delivered to the student and the student has mastered them. Our challenge will be a quality control mechanism to assure that kind of flexibility. But as we've talked with people at the local level about that idea, and they say, oh, you mean that doesn't mean that every single student, regardless of their course, is going to have to take the traditional theoretical Algebra 2 class. Oh, okay, this does make sense to us. You learn analytic skills in math and science that are useful in every conceivable way. And we don't want certain kids shut out of that anymore.
Yeah, let me ask you, because I have to go to my committee next door. We heard that when we were in Reedsport, and the shop teacher testified. And the shop teacher was pretty upset about this requirement because he said, my kids know how to measure. They know how to apply math to building things and doing things. And he was concerned that this new requirement would not allow him to substitute that kind of math for what you're asking now.
You know,
but it sounds to me like it's an integrated thing.
Quite the opposite. In fact, one of the examples we use in our white paper is construction math. That kind of application of advanced math skills in settings that where it makes sense depending on the student's individual plan.
But the key is going to be your quality control. As you
exactly.
Mentioned.
And being able to measure the standards.
Okay. Great. Well, I don't see my vice chair, so I'm going to turn this over to Senator Metzger while I go next door, and he'll continue. We have set for 45 minutes, and then if you'll just have a public hearing on the next bills, and I'll be back in about 20 minutes or so.
Are you going to pass something or obliterate something next door?
No, I'm not going to, well, partially obliterate.
Thank you very much.
If I don't get to see you again.
Thank you for getting this on.
Thank you, and I appreciate all the volunteer work that you all put in on the board.
Thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. The science requirement is to change from what is current two credits to 3, effective with the class of 2012. We originally had talked about those all being lab sciences or two of three. The advice that we got actually from our university and other partners was the key here is inquiry-based. And in many cases, that takes the form of a lab class. Here again, we've broadened the traditional definition of science. So it might be biology, it might be physics, it might be computer science, it might be agricultural science. The key is, are the science concepts embedded in the content? The arts, professional, technical, and second language is a change. Currently, one credit is required from among those. We're increasing that to three. The concern with that was, were we going to interfere with students' elective opportunities? We did some studies done, and in fact, Mr. Will did one at his very large high school, which is actually Century High School in Hillsboro, and found that there were 10 kids in this year's senior class who would not have met that requirement because many electives are in these areas. So we're trying to tie in some way elective choices to the personal plan and also assure that all students get some grounding in professional, technical, and or second language.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question
yes.
here? In what is your definition of arts for this section? What does the board define as arts classes?
Arts would be fine arts in the broadest sense.
So music, choir.
Choir, drama.
Drama.
Yes. And then that leaves among the 24, six credits to be chosen for electives. I want to underscore again the credit by proficiency opportunity. Because there has been some concern raised about the ability to deliver that many different discrete courses. And we think with the credit by proficiency, it's a manageable requirement and being done in most places. So there you see the summary of the total for 24 credits that we just looked at. The second major area is this idea of essential skills. There are some fundamental skills that the colleges, employers, citizenship, we know that all students need to do, and they really cross academic boundaries. We have identified these eight as essential skills. We started out with a list of proposed, I think at one time it looked like 50 to me. But these are skills that we really truly want to say, if you can't demonstrate that you can do this, we're not going to give you your diploma yet. And so we really honed it down. Read, write, speak, apply math, and then skills in proficiency with technology, with critical and analytical thinking, with civic and community engagement, global literacy, and then the career-related learning standards are already in place and have been. Those are those soft skills that we hear from employers, things like teamwork, promptness, and so forth.
What's global literacy?
Understanding of our place in the world economically and culturally. The kinds of understandings that we hope students learn largely through their social studies curriculum.
Okay.
Most of these, all of these actually, are embedded in the academic areas. We don't foresee some kind of set-aside assessment system being necessary for these. More a matter of identifying who'll be responsible to assure, and again, the quality control. The ability to speak, for example, is demonstrated in many, many ways in school, so you don't necessarily have to go take a separate speaking test to show this.
I guess I was just looking at when you're looking at civic and community engagement, global literacy, that's social studies, geography, history, I mean, it's all combined, and yet we're calling in something slightly different here, which is interesting. So,
well, I think the idea is that we want to assure that you haven't just taken the courses, but that you have demonstrated these things in order to get your diploma. Some of the assessments for these essential skills are clearly in place. Some others, we've got some development to do. And again, the implementation advisory team is going to be a very important part of working out just how do we decide that a student has met what standard for civic and community engagement, for example. What is that going to mean to get your high school diploma? I think we're ready here. This is the third part. We talked about this quite a bit when Chair Walker was still here, the personalization requirements. The first, the educational plan and profile that Mr. Will explained, beginning in seventh grade, based on students' goals and interests for all planning. Secondly, the career-related learning standards, which, as I said, have been in place as part of the Oregon High School Diploma. They actually were passed by the board, I'm going to say, 5 years ago, see, and in effect for the first time with this year's graduating seniors. A requirement that students have a career-related learning experiences that would be an opportunity to extend their learning into some kind of a career field of interest to them. And an extended application, the opportunity to apply their knowledge and skills in new and complex ways. Some schools use a capstone project. There are a variety of ways to do that. We won't necessarily limit or dictate how, but it needs to be part of the student's experience. So these are the key components of the new diploma. A couple of related questions, and then I'm going to stop so we have time for other questions, if you have them. What about SIM and CAM? Our hope is that we will be transitioning to a more rigorous diploma, embedding the best elements of SIM and CAM for all students, rather than just for those who opt to take the SIM test. We really appreciate that the bill that is being considered is one that extends to 2008 and 9 the elimination of those requirements, because it gives us an opportunity to work with the field and make sure that we don't drop out of the system those things that are going to be required for the new diploma. We want to signal the importance of mastering the essential academic and work-related skills for all students. And then finally, a little bit about work underway. The department and board are in the process of reviewing the content standards and assessments, trying to reduce the number of content standards. It's really a laundry list in some areas now, to a fewer number of power standards with the expectation of mastery. This is a K-12 endeavor. We aren't going to be able to increase what's expected for all students to get a high school diploma without that ratcheting down into the middle and elementary schools. We have been working very hard through a committee comprised of members from the joint boards, the Board of Higher Ed and the K-14 board, on aligning our expectations with post-secondary requirements. And finally, I think you've heard about the implementation advisory task force that is being created to address implementation issues, timelines, capacity, cost, teacher availability, all of those kinds of challenges. And that's the last slide here, I think. The key challenges that have been called to our attention as we have worked in our 300 community meetings and with stakeholders in the field are these. Potential for teacher shortages, especially in math, science, and second languages. That is improving in Oregon, but it's still a big issue. How we assure that those students who are struggling get the kind of support, whether it's tutoring, summer school, additional opportunities that they will need so that everyone has the fair chance to succeed. And the number one concern we hear from people is funding. You know, we can't do this on a dream or a whim, and we've heard that over and over again. Now let me stop. So that we can respond to
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thinking in terms of the primary grades and looking at the statistics we have at grade level competencies for grade 4 and grade grade 8, I believe it is, and the reasonably high level of competency at grade 4 and a dramatic reduction at grade 8. What's the board's thinking with respect to that issue and that problem as it sends students into a more rigorous program demand and requirements without the competencies to be successful?
Do you want to take that one on?
Well, many of us can answer that, maybe all of us. But one of my favorite pieces of testimony was a group of students who said, you need an eighth grade assessment and effectively a diploma. I mean, I think you're raising a really good issue. We do have benchmarks at every grade level, and to be successful in the high school program, we are going to need to work with the system in the middle school and below to make sure that students are meeting those standards. I would point out, though, even those who aren't meeting standards entering high school with intensive work, as Nikki describes, can meet the standards. I mean, but it's a much more effective program, obviously, if you're working with students and correcting and challenging at every stage. So this is a pivotal, the diploma is a pivotal piece of the whole education continuum, pre-high school and after high school, in terms of affecting change. And we need to be thinking about it in those terms.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I might add that we are right now reviewing the cut scores. There's some thinking that perhaps part of that problem is that there's too big a gap between what has been expected for the benchmark 3 and the benchmark 8. We also have feedback from students, particularly related to grade 10 performance. Why would we care? You know, essentially third graders go to school prepared to please their teacher, and the older they get, the more it has to be meaningful to them for them to actually perform on something. And the test needs to mean something for them in terms of their future. So we're trying to help it be more meaningful.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just be curious for maybe your internal discussions in the committee and on the board in terms of how you discuss one of these key issues, and that is relating to SimCam and the phase out. As you mentioned, taking the I call it Sim. I don't know why I call it Cam. We never really get to Cam, but to incorporate those best ideas that our teachers and schools have talked and worked very hard on for more than a decade. One in particular in my district, North Clackamas, who made it a central point. And obviously, as you know, some very disappointed that they spent so much energy and now we're, taking a detour down another course. But I applaud what the board has done in this, and I think that your vision is right on it. But here's the question I have, and I'm just kind of curious as to how the board talked about this. One of the biggest issues that we had with the SIM was that it wasn't meaningful, it wasn't adopted by other folks, and maybe even more importantly, that we had so many schools that just the kids, there wasn't enough kids that were achieving a SIM. So since they didn't achieve it, we don't want to have the requirement because I've only got 22% or I got 30%. And it was a requirement for graduation, so let's do away with it. Now we're moving into a system, and again, I want to make it clear, I like what you're doing, but I just kind of wonder how the board is going to approach this. Well, we're going to incorporate those best rigor into the new diploma requirements. Well, it's going to be meaningful because it now will be the diploma. And I've always kind of wondered what happens in 2012, 2014, and the schools start coming to you and say, only 22% of our kids can meet the diploma requirement now with the new stuff. Do we back away from it or because of the embarrassment of saying only one out of three kids gets a diploma anymore? I've just kind of wondered how that discussion is and then what our role is to provide support so that doesn't happen.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I believe that we have discussed that a lot with the board, with the meetings, etc. And I think that's the key as we're looking at it from a K through 12 basis of setting targets for students of where they ought to be. If they aren't there, intervention needs to occur, and you need to keep having the dialogue with the student and with the parent as they go through. There are examples in the state where school districts are taking action that they have the right to do, such as mandatory summer school between eighth grade and going to the ninth grade in high school, which shows some very, very promising results of spelling it out to students, this is what is expected. So when you take the total degree we're looking at, which is students focusing on outcomes of where they're going, focusing on how they're growing or not growing, how they're advancing, it's a whole unit that we've discussed we have to have in order to get students to be successful. I think your scenario about when we hit 2014, for example, and the math, and who isn't good, that is may be a reality for some districts. Then it becomes a question of what do we want that diploma to be, and is what we're asking reasonable regarding what students need to be successful in their future endeavor. I think that is, we have discussed that, we've struggled with that, but we're trying to look at the entire system so that intervention can take place. If a student isn't their third grade reading level at third grade, intervention needs to take to get them to get grade level so they can go on. And I think we are looking at that as systemically with ways that districts can do that, why it's important, and how you focus on that. So we are aware of that. That is one of the concerns. And if you've looked nationwide, some states have adopted stricter standards than we have, and you've seen newspaper articles about only 40% of the students are meeting the standard, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a problem, but we think we are looking at it in such a way that it's more apt when we get to 2014 that students are going to meet the standard.
Chair Cruz, Senator Metzger, I think the best example is North Clackamas. I mean, they're one of the few districts that required the SIM for graduation, and what they discovered is once you've required it for graduation, students step up to the challenge. And I think that certainly was one board member that motivated me a lot to think about this as a statewide expectation. I do think what Chair Walker and all of you are alluding to is the need to communicate and take this very seriously. I think this board is very serious about this, and I hope you are too. It will be a sea change in education if we're successful, and Oregon will be so much better off if we're successful. If everyone can read, write, apply math, at high level, at reasonably high levels. We're not talking about advanced calculus, but to be able to have some really fundamental skills to carry with them into their early college years, work, and into their lives as citizens, we will have a huge advantage as a state. But we do need to communicate, we need to fund, we need to make sure we're purposeful about this, and we need to be together.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, one other thing. We need to make it respectable to take a little longer,
right,
or go a little faster. And that's a bigger stumbling block than many of us realize. Lots of youngsters get within this close to a high school diploma, and they're too embarrassed to come finish. Most of them eventually come back in, as we know from statistics about how many people actually have the high school diploma or equivalency as you compare that with the so-called dropout rate. We need to stop calling youngsters who take longer than exactly 4 years dropouts and call them kids who aren't there yet, just as we would if they were working for their Eagle Scout badge.
I know we're out of time. I just got one fundamental question, and we have the board here for maybe the last time this session, so I thought I'd ask it. From your perspective, and this is a very simple question, what is the core function of K-12?
Our mission. Yeah. Answer that, Julie?
No, go ahead.
Well, that every student will leave high school able to succeed as a citizen, a scholar, or a worker. Every single student will be able to do that.
Okay, I appreciate that. Senator Walker and I have had conversations for months now about these issues. Would you also agree that looking into the future that all students are going to need something additional after K-12? Mm-hmm. Okay. I just, for for the members of the committee. I mean, I kind of look at that from a very layman's perspective. The core mission of K-12 is to make young adults who are ready to enter the world with the basic skills and the ability to learn.
Right.
And so, which is why what we're contemplating here is so important, because we are no longer in a world where a high school diploma takes you anywhere that we would want our children to go. They need to be prepared to go on to higher education or into some skill training. And I'm encouraged by this, and I appreciate the fact that you're not rushing into anything, because I think that's important. So, I personally just look at of whatever entity we're dealing with, what their core mission is, and how everything we're doing relates to accomplishing core mission. So I appreciate. I'm sorry I was not here for the whole presentation, but I thank you very much, and we'll close the public hearing, informational meeting, excuse me. And since I'll have the gavel, we're going to go off the agenda and do a whole bunch of other bills that Senator Walker won't let me do. So,
hey, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum, yes.
Let's go.
Going to open a public hearing on HJM2.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCM2 urges Congress to appropriate the maximum allowable amount of funds for the administration of IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act.
Okay, Denise Sutton and Eric Richards. Go ahead.
I have a handout too for when I'm done.
Okay.
Okay. Hi. Who's the chair?
I'm temporarily the chair, yes.
Okay. Anyway, hello, Mr. Cruz and members of the committee. I'm Denise Sutton. I'm a parent of two special education kids from the Nestucca Valley School District. I'm testifying on behalf of this bill, which wants to fund special education under IDEA. Currently, it is being underfunded. And about 3 years ago, my children had lost services for speech due to the fact that the district didn't have enough money to keep a full-time speech and language pathologist on duty. Needless to say, my children went a year without special education services. I filed a due process with ODE, and we settled for compensatory services. What happened that year is they brought a speech path, and at the end of the year, she reevaluated some students, my two students in particular, and she came in and she canceled the IEPs. We had hired a new superintendent. Mr. Rada left, went to the Oregon City School District. We brought somebody else in, and that September, the IEPs were reinstated again. I served on the budget committee, and I also ran for school board, lost by 10 votes. When I served on the budget committee, I noticed that we had taken the funds from Peter to pay Paul, or from Paul to pay Peter, and I saw a huge discrepancy in the amount of money that we allotted for speech pathology. 1 year it was $90,000, dropped to 20, and then went back up to 90. I asked why it went, you know, up and then went back down and went up again. And the superintendent explained it. First we had a need, then we didn't. And then in order to get our funding again, we had to have a need. Needless to say, these are people's lives here that we are playing with, and mainly they were my children. Time has passed, and you cannot make up for this year, last year. My son is in middle school, and I'm still battling. Filed another complaint with ODE. Over the fact that the IEPs are not being implemented. And they're not being implemented because we don't have enough services or staff, people available to carry them out. I feel like this needs to be a priority, especially, you know, come middle school time when I was promised 3 days a week for special ed services. And the special ed coordinator told me that normally we only meet with the kids once a week. This is the norm. It's called an IEP, which stands for Individual Personalized Instruction Plan. And I had told this person that it's not an we do what everybody else is doing plan. Needless to say, money seems to be a factor here. I attended an Oregon School Board Association conference that educated us on IDEA. And I had talked to one of our head school board members there at that conference, and he had told me that he had felt that dyslexia wasn't a disability and that it was all in my mind, and that it wasn't his job as the head school board member to make sure that our kids were reading. Obviously, this guy has never been inside the classrooms, and he's never seen the lack of neglect. We are a Title I school district, yet we don't have Title I help inside those classrooms. We have many kids that go undocumented or undiagnosed with learning disabilities. And I just attended an LDA meeting, bought the book by Betsy Ramsey, mailed it to Senator Kennedy, who's on the Workforce Education Committee in Washington, and begged him to fund IDEA and not to leave any children behind, because I think this is really important. I testified before a committee a while back, and I said the road to education has been a long and windy road, one with many obstacles in my way. During the time we had road construction, and I was also relating that in with, you know, higher ed and community colleges. But as a person with a learning disability, the road to education has been a long and windy road for myself as well. I did 8 years in special education, was never diagnosed learning disabled, just was recently tested and found out I had 5 disabilities, and mostly in the areas of dyslexia. And this impacts my learning. And yet, at a college level, I cannot get audiobooks or accommodations for my learning disability. We would never not give a wheelchair to a person that needed a wheelchair. A person that's blind, we don't expect them to read a book like everybody else. They get Braille. Why would we think it would be okay that we just not document or diagnose dyslexia in this state? And I feel that this is an inherited trait. My brother has it. My mom had it. They both dropped out of school. And due to the fact that the superintendent told me that my child was no longer a priority in education, that our new priority were the minorities and the poor kids, no child left behind, it's a huge disservice to our learning disabled children when we don't fund, you know, this and make them a priority too. We know that these children are average to above average intelligence, and with a little bit of teacher training and understanding into what a learning disability is and how to tap these individuals, these kids can lead very successful lives. The fact that if we ignore this, does not give these kids the tools to succeed, you know, in the next, you know, area. But once they get beyond the high school, or my son's already dropping off, and I had basically gotten something back for his IEP, and the teacher or the special ed director wrote in there that he appears to be unmotivated and an underachiever, and she's basically writing him off as lazy. He's disorganized and off task. Well, he went from, you know, elementary school to middle school, and the thing is, he went from having one teacher to 4 or 5 teachers, and only one teacher attends those IEP meetings. And so there's these expectations from going from class to class. There's a lot to keep track of when you're in middle school, and if you're a child with learning disabilities and you need those accommodations and you're not getting them, then you might appear to be disorganized or lazy or whatever the case may be. But I still think, you know, that we need to make sure that we treat everybody in the education system fairly. And I feel that we do a huge disservice to our learning disabled kids when we don't fund special education. And I think the federal government needs to step up to the plate. I am tired of being the only one going after them, and I need some help here, and I hope that you guys could all join me in the fight for getting, you know, services for all children in education. I think it's really important. And the very kids that we are leaving behind are our learning disabled kids due to the lack of understanding. And I hope that we can promote some teacher training. We did have a wonderful conference just recently. The Orbita group put it on, and it was called Literacy, a Capital Idea. And I went to it, and I was very inspired. And I have this so you guys can have it, you know, just kind of, I typed it up last night. It's just kind of my thoughts in a nutshell. I have dyslexia, and you know, you might find mistakes in this, but you know, I still, you know, reverse the puts and the buts, and you know, I'm in college and I have to have somebody, you know, edit my papers. I used to just feel like I spent 7 hours, you know, combing over something, having to do it myself, and I always thought it was cheating to have somebody help me. But you know, it's discriminating when you have a learning disability and you don't have, you know, the tools or the, you know, things out there that help you to succeed. You know, like a person needing a hearing aid or a blind person needing Braille. We need to make sure that learning disability isn't learning disability, that it's got a name and it's got accommodations, and nobody should ever say to somebody that dyslexia is all in your brain, because it is very real. To the people that have this, it's been very painful, that you experience a lot of failure. You know, it has been, you know, a lifetime of pain. My mom dropped out of school. She's got about a fourth grade education. She lives a life of poverty. And we know that, you know, a lot of our kids coming from lower social economic backgrounds may not ever get that diagnosis. They may not ever know that mm-hmm. they're learning disabled. They may go through life thinking they're dumb and stupid or that they're lazy. And so I think this is really important that we address this.
Well, and I agree, Ms. Sutton. I think the committee does, too. Thank you for traveling over here from the coast. And can you provide us with your written testimony?
Sure.
Terrific.
And,
thank you.
Like I said, I thought this is really important to come up for. You know, it's an hour and a half for me to come out up here, but I think this is so important. And if you guys Thanks. Can help advocate for this, because somebody told me that, I said, well, someday we're going to have the funding. And she says, oh, good luck, you know,
right.
not in
well,
this
we'll
state.
See
and
what
I said,
we can
well, you
do.
Know what, it takes people, not just not just me, but it takes all of us to be out there and vocal about it, because 17% is clearly not okay.
No, it's not. And we'll hear from the Department of Education a little bit here,
That would be wonderful.
All
Thank
right.
you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Sutton. Mr. Richards. Welcome. State your name for us and where you're from.
Good morning, Chair Walker and committee members. For the record, my name is Eric Richards, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Education today to testify in support of House Joint Memorial 2. And naturally, we're very pleased that it passed through the House unanimously and with no opposition. As you know, in 1975, Congress passed what was then known as the Education for All Handicapped Students Act, now known as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And the intent was to ensure that all kids with disabilities in every state receive a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. And as with many laws, the intent of that legislation is very honorable. And every child with a disability and special need deserves the same opportunity as any other student in the educational setting. But practically applying that law comes up short for our students with regard to the funding of it. IDEA authorizes Congress to pay for up to 40% of the excess costs of special education in every state. 32 years after the passage of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, we're now somewhere between 17 and 18%, not 40%, that the legislation allows for. And the recent trends for funding IDEA are a bit alarming. In 2005-2006 school year, there was a cut, and the projections are showing that for 2006-07, we can expect the funding to be about equal to or perhaps less than in 05-06, or in 04-05, excuse me. This decrease in federal funding is occurring at the same time as there's been a very significant increase in the number of students identified with disabilities that we need to serve here in Oregon. And the statistics that I've provided for you in this testimony are that there were 53,000 students on IEPs during the year 1990-1991. And if you look at the special education child count from 2005-2006, that number has now increased to 73,000 students with special needs and disabilities. That's about a 34% increase. Part of this increase can be attributed to a growing population, of course, but there are also other reasons. We are now able to diagnose and identify certain types of disabilities better than we've been able to in the past. And as medical science continues to improve, we'll continue to see more students diagnosed with autism, for example, and other specialized or unique needs that have gone unnoticed or undiagnosed in the past. Serving more students with special needs puts tremendous pressure on our ability to pay for these programs. In short, the need for special education funding is growing, while the federal government is providing less funding over the last couple of years in particular, and is still falling well short of the original promise to provide 40% of the excess cost of special education. School districts spend a great deal of time and money complying with the requirements of IDEA, yet Congress has not provided them with the funding in order to meet the additional requirements that come with each new reauthorization of the law. The department's intent with this joint memorial was to send a friendly but stern message to Congress and the Oregon Congressional Delegation that Oregon needs your financial help to ensure that all students and those with special needs and disabilities continue to receive the best education that we can provide for them. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, any questions from the committee? Mr. Richards, I think from what I've heard in my community, a number of the children with disabilities, their families are moving outside of the urban area because the price of housing is so high, and they have extra special costs involved with their special needs child, and so they're moving out into the rural communities where the housing is much less, and that's putting even more pressure on some of these rural schools because they don't have as much of a ability to pay for the extra education for these children. Is that true?
We don't have any statistics that would corroborate that, but it wouldn't be surprising if that is happening with some people. In addition, though, there are people also who move to the more urban areas because the therapies and the medical attention and that type of thing are better. And we do know from our fiscal data that the larger districts often bear excessive costs because of the higher need population that they serve.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Sutton's testimony was pretty clear about, you know, the problems with dyslexia, and but you also mentioned autism, and there are significant number more children being diagnosed with autism.
Definitely. That's a national trend, but here in Oregon, we are close to the top in the nation in the growth of students being identified with autism spectrum disorder.
Yeah, I really hope science figures out what causes autism so that we can prevent it instead of trying to deal with it at the end. And it is a surprise. There are many, many children being diagnosed today. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Well, thank you for your testimony. I don't see anyone else signed up.
Let's move it.
And I think we're ready to move this bill, so I'll close the public hearing on HJM 2, open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 2 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 2 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, questions, discussion? Okay. You want to call the roll, Ms. Cruvero?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Vice
Chair Hughes?
Aye. Aye. HGM 2 passes. We'll go to the floor. I'll carry this one. And we'll have a conversation later about something else. Okay. Let's close the work session on HGM 2 and open a... Where's my... Open a public hearing on House Bill 2265. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2265 permits Department of Education employees to transfer accrued but unused sick leave if they are subsequently employed by a school district or education service district. And the reverse would also be true. If a school district or education service district employee transfers to the Department of Education, they could transfer their accrued but unused sick leave. It declares an emergency and take effect July 1st, 2007.
Okay. We only have one person to testify, Mark Hunt from the department. You're really lucky, Mr. Hunt. We had to schedule some House bills because we didn't have all of our bills sent to our committee yet. Now we have so many we don't know what to do with them. And so all other House bills are probably going to wait until after we're all done with our Senate bills. So you slid in under the radar.
I appreciate your time. And in the spirit of your time, I'll try to expedite that.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Mark Hunt. I'm in the Director of Employee Services representing the Oregon Department of Education. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2265, which passed out of the House Education Committee unanimously and passed with strong support from the House floor. I've provided you with written testimony, and in the spirit of your time and appreciation for sliding in under the radar, I can either go through the testimony or be happy to answer any questions you might have. The bill is intended to remove unnecessary hurdles that we might have for getting highly qualified staff for the department. It is a permissive bill, and it is reciprocal so that employees could go back and forth in educational agencies so that they don't have the specter hanging over them of losing a valuable benefit if they had need of it. So, Senator Walker and committee, if you have any questions or if you'd like me to proceed in a certain way.
Question, both down here on the dais, Senator Metzger and then Senator Moore.
Well, just real quickly, I think your testimony clarifies this, but just for the record, so that if you, the portability of moving this from a different employer, but who is still a public employee, that if they were to utilize through a catastrophic event, the previous employers would be charged for that time that they had accrued under a previous employer, correct? And the state portion will only be the parts that they accrued as a state employee.
Actually, the Senator Walker, Senator Metzger, the time that was portable would be charged to the employer at that time. So, and that's the reason we put a permissive provision in there, so that if it wasn't necessary for the recruitment of new staff, you wouldn't need to, but it would be very similar to employees transferring from state agency to state agency. They would take their accrued sick leave with them and could use it at that employer. The only time that it might become a financial issue is if a person suffered a huge catastrophic issue that exceeded the amount of time that the employee would otherwise earn at the new employer.
Okay. So that seems to be the opposite of what my question was. And so then, so that the new employer absorbs the liability for the previous sick leave from the other employer?
Yes, they would. Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, the currently in employees that are transferring from one school district to another, it is the same way.
Right.
There is a limit up to, I think, 600 hours if you went from one school district to another. In terms of the portability, but that's why we put the permissive language in there.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is this bill really necessary? And that is from the perspective that sick leave is embedded in state law to accumulate 8 hours per month. And that is in statute for public employees, and I wonder why we need a bill that defines just transferring from one public employment to another public employment, why this bill would be necessary.
I think Mr. Hunt can answer that.
I'd be happy to. Senator Walker, Senator Morris, this is one of the areas that we stumbled on, that while the statutes do clearly provide sick leave provisions for all public employees, school districts and state agencies, for example, it did not provide for portability from a local education agency to state agency or state agency to local education agency. So it was a provision that, for whatever reason, that portability was provided between state agencies and between school districts, for example. It wasn't provided for going from state agency to local school district or local school district state agency. What brought this to this point is that as we were doing recruitment, more and more we were getting feedback from prospective applicants saying, okay, what are my benefits as we start to offer a position, and finding that, oh, I've got this sick leave and that's my insurance policy and you're asking me to leave it behind when I come to work for you. And as we started researching and finding the impact, felt that this was a good solution to remove that hurdle so that we could bring the best and brightest to the agency or to the school district.
And I think, Senator Morris, too, that sick leave is really important to folks. If you get an extended illness and you've had to leave it behind at your other job and you don't have it, then you're kind of out of luck. You're SOL.
Yeah. Yeah, Chair Walker, I'll use myself as an example. I have nearly 2,000 hours of sick leave that I've accumulated over my service with the state, and it's very valuable to me. It's my insurance policy for my family.
Mm-hmm. Senator Morris?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just as an observation, the average use of 71.28 hours per year of sick leave, that seems very high, that people would have that much actual sick time on a per-person basis, but for an average.
Senator Morris, I've been sick for 3 weeks now, and if I wasn't serving the legislature, I would have stayed home for at least a week with a sickness. And there you go. There's 40 hours right there. But I had to keep showing up and probably got other people sick. And you can also use, can you use your sick leave for family sick leave if your children are sick?
In certain examples, you
that
can.
Might be some
and that
of
would
it.
Be subject to collective bargaining agreement. There are some
okay.
provisions there.
So that might be why
yeah.
some of that's high.
Just an interesting observation.
Uh-huh. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, just something. Thank you, Madam Chair. You said that you've accumulated 2,000 hours of sick leave in the department. How would it work, for example, let's say a school district does have sick leave capped, and so let's say if you were going to transfer to a school district that had a cap at 600, would they be required to recognize your 2,000?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, that's the reason we put the permissive language in there. If I were to leave state agency and go to a local school district, the school district would have to decide whether they wanted to negotiate with me on how much sick leave to transfer in. So it's permissive.
So they would still have discretion?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and that is, I think that's the real sweet part of this bill, is and then allows them negotiation. And Mr. Hunt may decide, well, if they're only going to give me 200 hours, I'm not going anywhere. But if they can bump it up to 500 hours or 1,000, you might. I mean, it would be a matter of negotiation for hiring. Are you?
Well, and the other question is, how many on an annual basis, how many of these transfers from the department to schools or back and forth happen?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, I can get you that information. We track that in detail, and rather than give you misinformation from the top of my head, I'd be happy to provide that.
I mean, is it like 5, 10, 100?
We're talking probably about 15 to 20.
Okay. Just ballpark is fine. That's
yes. Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, for us, we also hire similar staff for the special schools, and
okay, right.
That's what will bump the number, and we also have quite a number of education program specialists within the department as well.
Okay.
Senator Morris, do you have another question?
Well, not a question, just a comment. In the interim, I had the opportunity to visit with the board of our ESD, Lynn Benton Lincoln, ESD.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing scenario planning based on what the response would be in the event of a pandemic. And one of the issues that they looked at was sick leave and its impact as an unfunded liability on all of the, I guess we have 11 school districts within those three counties. And the unfunded liability was over $45 million. It would bankrupt every school in our district. And they just raised that as a concern. And I don't know what we do with it, but pray to goodness we don't have something serious.
If we have a pandemic, we're in a lot of trouble.
In many ways, but that was it's a huge unfunded liability.
Any other questions of Mr. Hunt? Okay, thank you, sir.
Chair Walker's committee, thank you very much.
So, okay, good. All right, I'll close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2265. Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2265 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2265 to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Any further comments or discussion? Okay, you want to call the roll?
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2265 passes and goes to the floor. Would someone like to carry that?
Senator Morris would like to carry it.
Sure.
Okay. Good. Thank you. All right, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2266. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2266 instructs the Department of Transportation to inform the Department of Education of suspension, cancellation, or revocation of driving privileges of a person who has a school bus endorsement driver on their driver's license.
Madam Chair, this is a really, really, really simple one.
Okay, well, maybe Ms. Lincoln can come up and be really simple with it. With the Department of Education. You used to be with the Department of Employment or Revenue or someplace like that. What department was that? Because I've dealt with...
Sorry, that was Debbie Lincoln.
Oh, that was Debbie Lincoln. Oh.
For the record, my name is Deborah Lincoln.
Deborah Lincoln!
I'm
okay.
The Director of People, Transportation, and Fingerprinting for the Oregon Department of Education.
I bet the two of you get confused a lot in state government.
Good stories for you. We can
as long as she doesn't do anything bad. So, all right, great. Well, tell us what you would like us to know about this bill.
I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2266. The Department of Education issues a school bus certificate to all school bus drivers to ensure that they meet state qualifications before they transport students. The department has the authority to also revoke that school bus certificate and or suspend it if they no longer meet those qualifications. A school bus driver could be disqualified from transporting students if, for example, they do not have a commercial driver's license. It was either suspended or revoked. And this could happen, for example, if during the weekend they got a DUI and they lost their license. It can also happen if they write a bad check to the DMV. The DMV can also suspend their license, and there's they could also be suspended for not having insurance. There's a variety of reasons. Under the current administrative rule, the responsibility is for the driver to notify their employer, and then the school district, the employer or the contractor, then reports this to the Department of Education, and then we start the revocation or suspension process. The problem is that drivers do not always make this notification when they don't have a driver's license, either because they're not aware of it or they're choosing to hide this from their employer. And I have to tell you, this week, I came across a driver who had not had a driver's license since November. And they failed to tell their employer that they have been driving for 3 months without a driver's license. Some districts are enrolled in a particular program that the DMV notifies them if there's any action on that employee's license. And then the school district, of course, notifies the department. However, we're finding a couple problems with this system. One, drivers don't always want to report if they don't have a driver's license because this would impact their means to make an income. And districts don't receive this notification timely, even if they are in the system where the DMV reports. There is a little bit of lag time. So as a result, the notification does not reach the Department of Education as soon as it could. So this means that there are school bus drivers on the road without a proper license. And this could create a safety hazard for our students, a potential liability for the Department of Ed and the state of Oregon. Because school bus drivers have due process in the revocation and the suspension process, the sooner that we can notify them and start that process, the sooner we can get them off the road. During the 2005 legislative session, DMV, because of some federal requirements, required school bus drivers to have an S endorsement on their license. And this has created a very unique opportunity for us because now this sets commercial drivers apart. School bus drivers are the only ones that would have this S endorsement. The only exception would be people who moved in from another state that happen to have that S on their license, and usually, by the way, they become school bus drivers. Or somebody who was a former school bus driver that is no longer, that S would just stay on their license. House Bill 2266 would ensure that the Department of Education would receive timely updates from anyone who has lost their driving privileges that has this S endorsement. And I want you to know that we already handle confidential information. We already have procedures in place that would protect this information. We already have access to driver's license records through the LED system. But we need assistance in seeing which licenses we should look at. I can't keep checking 6,000 records every day. So with this process, the DMV would actually notify us which one was suspended or canceled, and then we could go in and look at the individual record to see what's going on. We have been in contact with both ODOT and the DMV about this legislation, and they support the bill, and they would agree to work with us in a rulemaking process that would make this efficient and effective in a reporting mechanism. And also, this did pass through the House unanimously, and so I would like to urge the committee to support this bill and helping us make our children safe. And I thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Ms. Lee, I was just curious, as I was looking at your testimony, the S endorsement is very interesting, and I think that's good. And I certainly am supportive of this legislation. You know, a lot of our school bus drivers, of course, are contracted from various organizations that contract with school districts to provide services. Do we have a drug testing requirement for school bus drivers in Oregon at all? I mean, is that a requirement at all?
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, one-third of our drivers across the state are contracted. The rest would be self-operated by the district itself. And, yes, in fact, they have to meet federal requirements to be drug tested. And so prior to pre-employment, there has to be a drug testing. They have to be in a drug testing pool. And the supervisors all are required to be trained so they could recognize reasonable suspicion should the driver show up to, you know, be inebriated or under the influence. There's also post-accident requesting, testing. So it is the same as the federal requirement because it falls under the CDL, the commercial driver's license. So, yes, sir, all of our drivers are in the drug testing pool.
So there won't be any medical marijuana patients driving school buses.
We would be against that.
I'm sure you would. All right, any other questions? Okay, thank you. I think Senator Cruz said it, hit the nail on the head. This is a very simple little bill. And what would you like to do, Senator Cruz?
I'd like you to go into work session. So
okay. I'm going to close the public hearing and go into work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2266 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2266 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any other comments, questions, discussion? None. Heather.
Senator Aye.
Senator Moore. Aye.
Reluctantly excused.
Yeah.
Aye.
Senate Bill 2266 passes. And Senator Metzger, since you like drug testing, that bill's going to be all yours.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Yes.
A number of us have received notification that we have a number of young people in our audience today with us.
Okay. Well, let me close the work session on this bill. House Bill 2266 will close the work session. And now...
From Gilkey International Middle School. And what is Geneva Lee, correct? Yeah, well, welcome to our committee.
And, Madam Chair, I also have a shadow as Alex Murphy.
Oh, great. And I have a shadow, too, but I've forgotten her name because I don't have it written down. Mandy? Okay, Mandy, very nice to have you with us, all of you. We're really pleased to have you at the Capitol, and you can see how we do the people's work. Sometimes we have fun, and sometimes we're really serious. Today it's a little bit of both. All right.
It's serious fun.
We're going to go into work session. Let's quickly punch out 198. So we'll open a work session on this little bill, Senate Bill 198.
Madam Chair, pleases the Chair and the committee members, I'd be inclined to speak to the Dash 4 amendments only.
Yes, please.
Yes.
The Dash 4 amendments are the same as the Dash 1 amendments, except that they have a different definition of a diploma mill. It changes the diploma mills that the commission may terminate. It deletes the specifications for the commission to rule whether a school is a diploma mill. And finally, it takes out the language about titles conferred upon completion of degree programs because there's no such thing.
Okay. Well, we've read a lot about this bill. We're very glad to have it finally, excuse me, at a point where we can get rid of it.
Madam Chair, I'll move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 198.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 198. Any discussion? I hope not. We've had plenty. All right. So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 198 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Great. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 198 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, questions? Anything? Okay. Ms. Gravel, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Chair Walker? Aye. Senate Bill 198 is approved and passed. And Senator Cruz, you don't have one yet today, so...
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, I'll close the work session and open a work session on Senate Bill 334, our last bill of the day.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have a bill and a Dash 1 amendment in front of you. The bill itself replaces the Oregon Opportunity Grants with the Oregon Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grants that would be administered by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. This bill changes the method of determining the cost of education and authorizes the commission to determine student, family, federal, and state share of the cost of education. It deletes the intent language to empower and reward students who have earned a certificate of initial mastery. It applies to qualified students who attend eligible institutions for the first time on or after July 1, 2008, or who do not continuously attend an eligible institution before the 2008-2009 academic year, or who attend an eligible institution on or after July 1, 2011. It allows eligible students who are currently attending an eligible student to receive the grant amount under current law or under this act, whichever is greater. The Dash 1 amendment removes the Oregon Health and Science University in determining the average cost of education. It also removes loans from the student share for community college students.
Great. Ms. Lau, do you want to come up and talk a little bit about these Dash 1s, please? Ms. Richardson does a good job of telling us what they are, but I want to know the little history behind some of these changes.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm policy advisor in the governor's office. The Dash 1 amendments are clarifications of the decisions and recommendations that were made by the Access and Affordability Work Group, composite of all of the stakeholders who were involved in helping shape the shared responsibility model grant program. To just walk quickly through... I think Dana did a good job of summarizing them. The initial amendments, the ones that change the criteria for the grant, are on page two, rather, and it removes the OHSU students' tuition from the average grant award size. This is a small group of students. They're in now an institution that operates in many ways like a private institution instead of one of our public institutions. And but if they were left included in the average, it would raise the grant award for all of our students in four-year institutions by $1,000, which is not in our cost projections and was not in our initial work recommendation. So
it would pretty much bankrupt the system.
It would cause us to have to remove a lot of students who are in the upper ranges of eligibility from the program in order to afford that. So we think that's an important change to make. The changes on line 37 on page 2 simply clarify that the commission is to consider the number of hours of work rather than paid work as a clarification. Again, embodying the recommendations from the AAWG task force. Then on lines 43 through 45, our intent here is to clarify that for community college students, the grant award calculation is predicated under the assumption that students would not be required to borrow in order to pursue their first 2 years of school. But then for students who choose to attend four-year institutions, the composition of how they would fund their share would be a combination of borrowing and work effort that would lead to their contribution. Then moving on to page 3, in terms of amendments there, the amendments at the top of the page are just part of the clarification that I just spoke to. But then further down the page, on line 36, there we are again clarifying existing language so that it's more straightforward about what the total term of eligibility is that a student would have. We've already had discussions in the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee about how much eligibility a student would have. But right now, our basis for calculating the overall size of the program gives students 4 years total of eligibility. That's considered to be either three quarters in a quarter-based school or two semesters in a semester-based school. And we wanted to make sure that as we blend students who are currently recipients under the present opportunity grant program and as they transition into shared responsibility, that overall they maintain still four total years of eligibility between the two programs, or if they're just an entering student, that they'll have 4 years of total eligibility under the shared responsibility model.
Okay.
And the last change is on page 4, where we simply modify line 18 to clarify that if circumstances change beyond what was expected once the proposal is approved by the legislature in any particular biennium and the commission needs to make revisions to that, that they would bring those proposed changes back to either a subsequent legislature or to an emergency board meeting. Continuing what we've stated all along is this being really a strong partnership between the legislative and executive branches to help our students really achieve their post-secondary education dreams and needs.
Okay.
I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Yeah. Do we have any questions of the committee?
Pretty clear.
Yeah. Well, you did a good job of explaining that, and I think those are all good, important changes that needed to be made. All right. Thank you, Ms. Lau. We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 334.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 334. Any discussion? Committee, I think we've had quite a good hearing on this in several different venues, and I'm anxious to send it down to Ways and Means and have them, our committee, Senator Morse, go through it again. Okay, no objection. Then the Dash 1 is ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 334 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Does this not have a referral?
No, it does not.
Does it have a referral? Well,
no money in the bill, so.
No money in the bill.
No, okay, the money's coming separately. Well, I'll be darned. That's a great thing. I can carry this with Senator Schrader.
Assuming it passes.
Assuming it passes this committee. So Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 334 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. You want to put in a few words, or you're all done? Good to go?
Good bill.
Good bill. Okay, Ms. Gravel.
Senator Metzler? Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Excuse.
Vice Chancellor.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 334 will go to the Senate. Thank you very much. I will carry that with Senator Schrader. And I'm very pleased to do so. Okay, we'll close the work session. And colleagues, I think that's it. Unless there's anything for the good of the order, we've cranked out our agenda. All right, we'll close the committee. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.